Today in Studio 360, the Men in Black are back for a third movie. Can they still keep up?
I am getting too old for this. I can only imagine how you feel.
I'll talk with the movie's director, Barry Sonnenfeld, about what makes Men in Black different from a lot of sci-fi blockbusters.
You don't want people to talk about how great the special effects are because you want them to be so immersed that you think those things are real.
And after 20 years, the super fabulous ultra 80s primetime soap opera is also back.
J.R. Ewing always keeps his promises.
You're not a human being, you're scum!
A new Dallas premieres on TNT next month. Meanwhile, the original series is still airing all over the world.
Everyone believed that's the American reality, that everything is shiny, glamorous.
Today we look at what made Dallas an American icon. That and more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. On today's show... For our American Icon series, we go deep into Dallas. Not the city, but the imaginary place that captivated TV audiences all over the world. But first, 12 years into the millennium, the big splashy comic book movie is a predictable, formulaic piece of Hollywood machinery. You cast a few wisecracking superheroes, mix in some freakish bad guys and spectacular special effects, and ka-ching! Another summer blockbuster rolls off the assembly line. With all that, it's easy to forget just how radical and fresh Men in Black seemed when it came out in 1997. It was based on a Marvel comic, and this smart, funny sci-fi adventure starring Will Smith and Tommy Lee Jones was instantly, hugely, unexpectedly popular with critics and audiences, including me. Men in Black was directed by Barry Sonnenfeld, and this week he's back with the third movie in the series. Barry Sonnenfeld, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks, Kurt. Great to be here.
So, it's been 15 years since the first Men in Black film and 10 since the previous sequel. What compelled you to return to this idea and this universe?
Well, for me, the reason I'm doing it again is I read a script about 3 years ago that was fantastic. It was different. It wasn't a tired, let's get a new villain to come to Earth and destroy Earth and our guys have to save it. Because our movie involves time travel, we get to go back to...
One of my favorite science fiction notions.
Well, you know what? They're really hard, as it turns out. I can't tell you how many times Will Smith and I watch Back to the Future. Because that one sets up the rules, the audience understands the rules, and they're never confused. And that was our goal, to make a time travel, Men in Black, double genre movie that works.
Last chance, who are you and what do you know?
I'm an agent of Men in Black, but I'm from the future. We're partners. 25 years from now, you're going to recruit me. And 14 years after that, the guy you didn't let me kill today at Coney Island, he escapes from prison and jumps back in the past and unleashes a full-scale invasion of Earth. We had about 19 hours to catch him and kill him, so really, we need to go right now.
All right.
And did you feel, okay, Men in Black 1, amazing, changes the nature of filmmaking, makes everybody lots of money, makes you famous. Did you feel like, the second one, not as good as it could have been? I need to redeem it?
The problem for us about the second one is we forgot or misunderstood what made the first one so good. We thought it was comedy. So the second one, what we did is, it's probably funnier than Men in Black 1, but it doesn't have really strong emotion. It doesn't have a great villain. You don't want anyone to know they're working on a comedy when they're doing a comedy. You don't want the cinematographer to know because he'll make it too bright. You don't want the composer to know because he'll make the music too happy. And you definitely don't want the actors to know because they'll make it, quote, funny.
If not mugging, but it's a subtle performance thing?
Yeah, I think what you have to do is create great writing so the situations are funny or absurd. And then the actors play the reality for that absurd situation. And in the second one, we just had too much of Frank the Pug singing I Will Survive.
Yeah.
Movies are very plastic, and it's a really weird medium, and sometimes you think you know all the answers.
And you don't know those things until you've shot half of it sometimes?
No, you usually don't know it until you shoot and edit the entire movie.
Huh.
On Adam's Family, I kept saying to Dee Dee Allen, who's one of the great editors ever, she did Reds and Bonnie and Clyde, I kept saying, what's wrong with our third act? And she said, I can fix it. And we came in the next day, and I said, it's so much better. What did you do to the third act? She said, I didn't touch it, but I lost that scene in the second act that was repetitive to what's in the third act. And you don't, you know, your brain can take all sorts of leaps, but until you see it acted
put together,
and put together, you I can't tell you in every movie I've done how the biggest problems that you think the audience is going to have are never where the problems are.
This movie, Men in Black 3, is your first 3D movie?
Yes.
You started out as a cinematographer, and you have said, quote, 3D is like a perfect medium for the way I see. What does that mean?
The best way to shoot 3D movies or to project 3D movies is that the imaging should be very much on axis. The eye line of actors should be towards the lens. Profiles don't work well. Panning doesn't work well. Tracking towards and away from objects do.
It's more old-fashioned, right?
Well, I wouldn't say old-fashioned. Actually, I would say uniquely Sonnenfeldian.
Uh-huh.
I shot the first three Coen Brothers movies.
Right.
Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, and Miller's Crossing. And when I saw A Serious Man, which they did fairly recently ago, I said to them, it's the best movie you've done since I was your cinematographer. And that, there's about 12 movies in between. And they said, why? And I said, it's the first movie since I worked with you where you didn't pan. I think panning is a very lazy way of storytelling, and it actually is the enemy of 3D.
So you shot the first three Coen Brothers movies. There's some shared DNA in some of their films, a certain arch looniness. Do you feel like you took certain things from working with them on a few films that is now part of your directorial approach?
No, I think they took things from me.
Really?
Yeah.
Damn them.
I was glad to share. The truth is, the first time we were on the set of our first movie, Blood Simple, was the first day that Joel, Ethan, or I had ever been on a movie set. I did not work my way up as a cinematographer. Joel hadn't directed anything except a student film. Ethan was a philosophy major at Princeton and worked as a statistical typist at Macy's. And then we were shooting Blood Simple. So we shared a common visual style, which is that the camera can be a character or actor in your movie. So I sometimes use the camera as a way to grab the audience and say, come on, let's go on this adventure. Like, for instance, when Will jumps off the Chrysler Building in Men in Black 3, there's a self-consciousness in some cases to the camera, falling through space in ways that cameras can't do.
Uh-huh.
The fact that the camera will independently of motivation push in on a character are all things that I think unconsciously bring audiences in to the filmmaking experience of watching this movie.
I'm interested in what a cinematographer can do to have different emotional effects. I mean, in addition to making movies with the Coens, for instance, you shot big studio movies like Big, like When Harry Met Sally. And, of course, in that film, everybody knows the famous Katz's Deli scene with Billy Crystal and Meg Ryan. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if you could walk us through what you did behind the camera on that scene to make it work better. And I guess I should give a heads up to parents with little kids around. You might not want them to hear this.
Nothing. It's just that all men are sure it never happened to them, and most women at one time or another have done it, so you do the math.
You don't think that I can tell the difference?
No.
Get out of here.
A lot of times what makes a comedy scene work is actually length and pregnancy. And, you know, oftentimes really good jokes are a function of setup more than punchline.
Are you okay?
Oh.
So what we have here
oh,
is
God.
Until Meg starts her orgasm. And some of this is direction, some of this is editing, but the whole scene takes place in over the shoulders. There's not a close-up.
You're seeing her over
Billy Crystal's shoulder or vice versa. Or you're in a profile two-shot, so you're not cutting to her close-up until you need to when she starts the orgasm. So that's where the emphasis starts.
Oh, God. Oh.
I'll have what she's having.
I've seen some of your list of favorite movies, and certainly we share Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove and 2001 as well.
Yeah.
Are there things you actually either consciously or then subsequently unconsciously find you're doing Kubrickian things?
No one can do Kubrickian things, but I will say that in every movie I make, I try to put the recall code from Strangelove, which is OPEPOE, and you'll see that in many movies I've shot for the Coens, or the CRM 114 discriminator, which is a box that receives the recall code in Dr. Strangelove. There are several places in Men in Black 3, and no one really thinks of him as a comedy director, but I got to say, Strangelove is as brilliant a comedy as I've ever seen. And there are scenes that go on for 3, 4, 5 minutes without a cut. The opening shot where George C. Scott comes out of the bathroom in the underground bunker with all the mirrors is 4 or 5 minutes, not a single cut. And the audience unconsciously is aware of that and realizes they're in the scene with them. And Kubrick never cuts to a close-up for a punchline, except in a couple of places where it fails, when I think he fell in love too much with George C. Scott's comedy. It's the only thing about that movie that isn't perfect.
That's interesting, because again, as you say, you try to make funny movies where the people don't know they're making a funny movie. One of the reasons that movie works so well is for that, except, as you say, I never thought of that. When they go in for George C. Scott's crazy bluster.
What did you say?
I said Premier Kissoff is a degenerate atheist.
Mr. President, I formally request that you have his ignorant boot.
I'm sorry.
Mr. President, I think they're trying the number.
And I think that Kubrick must have accidentally fallen in love with that. Again, tonally, it's the only thing in that movie that's slightly self-conscious.
Oh, you warm my thing for it. Gentlemen, you can't fight in here. This is the war room.
You said things more than once about how this is a job you're hired to do. You're not this, you know, crazy auteur. You have to do it as good as you can to make money for the studio. Is that just charming self-deprecation, or do you really feel you're different from a certain kind of movie director?
Okay, Kurt, you found me out. It's
charming
self-deprecation.
And you
were the first one to actually ask me the question straight on. Yes, it's charming self-deprecation.
Good. So you're just as much an artist as any of those guys.
I have just as much ego as any of those guys.
And although I presume you're happy to make good movies and be paid well and all that, when you're in the middle of shooting a movie, is there anything good about that in terms of the way it makes you feel?
You know, I've come around to really love directing. I love working with actors. I love being in charge of hundreds of manly men. I love that someone can bring me a cappuccino and I can reject it because it looks more like a latte and doesn't have enough foam. Although I'm more of a black coffee guy, so that doesn't happen that often. I can say every morning I'd like a deviled egg, and I get it.
So it's just like you're a dictator of your little country for 6 months.
Yeah, and then I go home and I say to Sweetie, my wife, where's the butter? And she means, do you want me to go to the fridge and get you the butter? And I go, no, I'm sorry, dear. I'll go get the butter.
So really, the stress and all the moving parts and the jillions of dollars and all that is you've made your peace with that.
I should be so lucky that I get to do this. And stress is a great dietary tool.
Barry Sonnenfeld, thank you very much.
Great.
Barry Sonnenfeld is the director, among other movies, of Men in Black 3, which is out in theaters this weekend. And think you can find all those Kubrickian codes that Barry Sonnenfeld said are in his movies? If so, let us know at studio360.org. Coming up, It is the show that in the late 20th century defined Texas, and by extension, the rest of America.
It made Dallas, which was this grouchy, adding machine kind of actuarial city, look kind of cool and romantic. So Dallas then embraced the myth and in some ways became like the TV show.
Dallas is up next in our exploration of American icons. This is Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. In our ongoing American Icon series, we look long and deep at great individual works of American art and culture, work that tells us who we are or who we were. We've gotten lots of good nominations from listeners, but this one we couldn't pass up.
One show changed television forever.
We're in the oil business, boys.
Now,
good timing, Laura. Next month, the cable network TNT relaunches Dallas, the first new episode since the program ended in 1991. And 2 decades later, once again, with Larry Hagman, Patrick Duffy, and Linda Gray as the Ewings. Julia Barton grew up in Dallas, Texas, back when the show was first on the air, and she'll help us figure out how this not exactly highbrow series became an American icon.
7 years is a long time, J.R., and there's nothing wrong with me.
Over the holidays, I was back home in Dallas, watching Dallas with two friends. I've known Jennifer since kindergarten.
Where are you going?
You better stop drinking, Suella. There's nothing uglier than a woman can't handle her liquor.
J.R., you can't.
Yeah, like anybody would really care if someone had a drunk wife in Dallas.
I got to get something home, aren't you?
All right, darling. I'll buy you a puppy.
This is episode 10 from the first season. It's called Black Market Baby. Okay, JR hasn't touched his wife, Sue Ellen, in like 7 years, and Bobby's wife was going to have a baby 5 episodes ago, but then JR accidentally, on purpose, pushed her off the hayloft and she lost the baby. Now she might try again to get pregnant, so Sue Ellen decides if she can't have the first baby, she'll just buy one. So she goes to meet the birth mom in a bad neighborhood in Dallas, and this is why we're watching. My friend Jennifer and her brother got to be extras.
Oh, there I am. That's me.
We see the back of Jennifer's head. She's in a shopping cart being pushed by her brother.
Totally saw Vance. Vance is like staring. Ah.
Vance was 7 and Jennifer was 9 when this aired in 1978. Their dad worked as a key grip on the local set of Dallas.
I guess mostly I cared about the chuck wagon. There's a guy that sat in there all day long, and his job was to cook whatever you wanted for everybody on the set, anything you wanted, as much as you wanted. And I must have ate like 2 pounds of bacon that day because I love bacon.
Of course, most of the time, Dallas was filmed in California, but we in the Sun Belt got more out of it than just bacon. It showed us as powerful, ruthless, in charge. Our moment was beginning. Dallas foretold and glorified not just the Reagan Revolution, but all kinds of huge changes that have made America what it is now. Not that CBS was thinking about any of that when it commissioned the show. They just wanted a saga. Those were big days for TV sagas.
The word saga to me meant Texas, which I had driven through once in my entire life.
That's David Jacobs. The Hollywood studio Lorimar hired him to come up with a scenario. Jacobs got the Ewing name from a billboard he'd seen on that drive through Texas. He gave them a Cain and Abel story, pitting Bobby, who looked so handsome with his shirt off, as it often was, against the mean older JR.
He's taken over his father's empire. He's probably multiplied its worth 10 times, has more money and power than his father ever had, and yet his younger brother is still his father's favorite.
And the Ewings have a Romeo and Juliet-style feud with a rival clan, the Barneses. Bobby marries a Barnes, and JR will never forgive him.
Now, listen here, little brother.
No, I won't listen. And you can stop that little brother nonsense, too, because that stops from here on in.
Hold on.
Oh, we'll always be brothers, JR. But if you ever try and force me to choose, there's not a chance in a million I'd choose you or any family above my wife.
David Jacobs' concept for the show had nothing to do with Dallas, Texas, till he sent it to a studio executive.
He said it was fine, but I changed the name. And I said, well, what did you call it? He said, Dallas. And I said, what do you mean Dallas? I don't know that this is set in Dallas. He said, well, it sounded good to me. It sounded better than Houston.
Poor Houston. They're the ones with the oil, and Fort Worth has the cattle. Dallas had bankers, insurance brokers, and technology geeks. And they didn't wear cowboy hats.
Nobody wants to be country here. That's why the people in the real country hate Dallas.
Did you ever see Dallas from NBC 9 at night?
Jim Schutz writes a column for the Dallas Observer called Get Off My Lawn. He came here the same year that the TV show started, when the city was more associated with JFK than JR.
When I came to Dallas in 78, there was a guy at the Dallas Morning News who was still covering the assassination in 78. But his job was to write about conspiracy theories, sort of enthusiastically, because Dallas was eager to discover any theory by which it was somebody else's fault. Russians, the mafia, just somebody who wasn't Dallas.
Well, Dallas is a rich man with a death wish in his eyes. A steel and concrete soul in a war.
Texan Jimmy Dale Gilmore picked up on that Dallas hint of menace and shame even before Hollywood did. But then Hollywood took JR, the bad man who just didn't care what people thought, and made him the hero.
It made Dallas, which was this grouchy, adding machine kind of actuarial city, look kind of cool and romantic. So Dallas then embraced the myth and in some ways became like the TV show.
Rebranded and set free. That's the Dallas I remember. We could not build malls and skyscrapers fast enough. We could not perm our hair out big enough. We threw up subdivisions of giant houses with big chandeliers and enormous foyers. We hurled forth megaton versions of JR, H. Ross Perot, George W. Bush. But I'm getting ahead of myself.
Because it was so successful in that second season, CBS asked Dallas to do four additional shows.
David Jacobs, the creator of Dallas.
They already had their cliffhanger. And somebody, and nobody knows whether it was Camille Marchetta, who was the story editor, or some people say it was Art Lewis, who was the producer, but somebody said, let's shoot the son of a bitch.
That was the spring of 1980. By summer, Larry Hagman was on the cover of Time. The November 1980 episode of Dallas, the one that revealed JR's would-be assassin, remains the most viewed hour of television ever. More than 350 million people tuned in worldwide. The bullets hardly slowed JR down. By then, he was everywhere.
Every place that JR stomps is a section of neighbor's fence. He softly walks and gently talks and never leaves tracks in the land. But old JR has gone real far on the backs of his fellow man. JR! Who do you think you are? JR! You're pushing for super!
It wasn't just JR that made the show popular. It was the glamorous lifestyle, the giant swimming pools. And the people who fell for it the hardest were those who didn't know any better. People like Yock Kilmy, living in drab apartment blocks behind the Iron Curtain.
All these Soviet-Estonian living rooms look the same. We had the same cupboards, same sofas. Brown, of course. What color do you expect a Soviet sofa to be?
Kilmy grew up in Soviet Estonia. Dallas was banned, of course. But Kilmy's dad, lots of dads in Estonia, built converters to get TV signals from Finland. His mom would translate the subtitles from Finnish into Estonian every Friday night.
I remember these Saturday mornings or Saturday nights when the last episode of Dallas were discussed over and over again.
Kilmy's made a documentary film. It's about how shows like Dallas weakened the hold of communism.
You know, everyone believed that that's the American reality. people want us to believe that, you know, people live in skyscrapers and have beautiful cars and everything is shiny and glamorous.
Kilmeade's not the only one who thinks this kind of dynamic made shows like Dallas into a geopolitical force. Matt Welch is the editor of the magazine Reason.
We should celebrate these kind of semi-vulgar pop culture things and understand that people adapt and use them and create their own cultural artifacts that are inspired by them in a way that inexorably leads towards human liberation. And that's a good thing.
It's not that Dallas ended the Cold War, but Welch cites the case of Romania. The dictator Nicolae Ceausescu allowed Dallas to be shown on state TV, thinking it was a critique of American capitalism. Oops.
Nu știu cum s-a întâmplat asta, sincer, pentru că pe vremea aia noi aveam...
That's Rodica Florea. I met her near the city of Slobozia. She says in the last days of Romanian socialism, they had only 2 hours of TV a day, and half of that was news propaganda. So Dallas was a big deal.
Lady! Hai, fetița, haide!
Florea now manages Parcul Vacant Hermes, a hotel and ranch complex. I've heard it referred to as South Forkescu. The stables are filled with ponies, a horse, and puppies. A local tycoon named Ilie Alexandru built this place. He wanted to be the JR of Romania. He dressed in a cowboy hat, cowboy boots, the whole thing. Here, in the middle of farmland, he tried to build a replica of South Fork Ranch. He lined a long driveway with trees. He built an extra mansion in the back with an 8-car garage.
Wow. That's pretty amazing. That's huge. He was building a lot of things all at once, huh?
The JR of Romania ended up in prison for a variety of financial crimes. While in jail, he told a newspaper, quote, "I admire JR, but I was like Bobby. The Bobby inside me finished me."
Oh, Dallas, you shine with an evil light. How'd you turn a billion steers into buildings made of mirrors?
Even at the real South Fork Ranch, the one outside Dallas, people seem puzzled why the show has so much traction.
I keep thinking, well, maybe no one will come next year. That's not the case. We do 11 tours a day.
Adele Taylor is a tour guide here. She tells us all the tricks the TV crew and actors used to make South Fork look huge, especially the pool.
You would see them dive off of the board, they would swim away, and then they swam out of the frame of the camera, so they were gone. And they were down at the other end, we thought, of that long, long pool.
The pool, of course, is tiny. The long driveway, not so long. The house is smaller than a 90s McMansion. The illusion is what strikes everyone who visits here. But it's the illusion that we've bought for so long, that we, like Ewing Oil, will keep getting bigger and wealthier forever. Jim Schutz says that Dallas, Texas bought the myth and became more like the show. Just check out the new Cowboys Stadium if you want to know what he means. But it's not just Dallas, Texas. We all bought the myth.
In Africa, c'est presque tout le monde qui aime Bobby. On n'aime pas JR là-bas. On dit qu'il est méchant.
On my tour of South Fork, I met Simon Ntobi. He's from the Democratic Republic of Congo. Now he lives here in Dallas. For him, the show is all about the American dream.
American dream is not true, is not also false.
Not true, but also not false.
It depends to what you want to do. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, when I came in America, I didn't have money. You know what I'm saying? I think only $5.
Dallas gave Simon the heads up that the American dream would be kind of brutal and competitive, with no one looking out for the weak.
In French, that song, they say, Dallas, malheur à celui qui n'a pas compris la vie. Donc, malheur à celui qui n'a pas compris la vie. You understand? Yeah.
Bad luck to he who does not understand. One day he could lose his life. Somewhere in the world right now, the original show is still airing, teaching more people about our cycles of boom and bust, our desperate housewives and scheming tycoons. But it's not broadcast in America anymore. We know the story too well. We all live in Dallas now. For Studio 360, I'm Julia Barton.
It won't be long before Dallas 2.0 is on TV after all. The new Dallas premieres on TNT June 13th. And you can also check out all of our American icons in the series, from Moby Dick to Superman to the Barbie doll to Monticello, Great Gatsby, and lots more at Studio360.org. Here on the show, all the time we ask people about works of art that changed their lives. This week, we've got one from the singer-songwriter Dave Alvin. 30 years ago in Los Angeles, Alvin founded the rootsy punk band called The Blasters with his brother Phil, and they were a big deal in the 1980s. Since then, Dave's lived the life of a yeoman musician, playing on the road to small but devoted audiences. It hasn't always been easy. He told us about the time he almost gave up.
I never had a plan in my life. When we started The Blasters, I was a fry cook. Everything kind of went really well with no plan. We became, you know, I won't say rock stars, we became cult heroes. Well, you were soldier four on leaving West Berlin. No music there that rocks, just 1,000 violins. They want to hear some American music. Then I made a solo record for CBS Records, the same as Bruce Springsteen and Bob Dylan. Wow, man. And did that, and then everything came to just crashing down on me. In the late 80s, you know, the whole thing was like hair bands and Richard Marx and power ballads. I'm not that kind of guy. And if you wanted to get a record deal, you know, you had to do something along those lines. And at the same time, I was aging, you know. I wasn't a kid really anymore, so I couldn't jump on whatever bandwagon kids were doing. You know, hey kids, you know, make room for dad. We started the band March of 79, and then here it was 1987 into 88. I was massively in debt. My mother had died, friends had died, my entire world had changed. You know, the idea of writing a song just was repugnant to me. I just decided, you know, screw the music industry. It was 89, 90. A friend of mine, a woman named Rosemary Patronette, called me up and said, Curtis Mayfield's playing the Palomino. I was like, what? It was a place that had been for years the number one honky-tonk in Southern California. She goes, yeah, can you believe it? And I said, so we went down to the Palomino, and there was maybe 80 people there. This is, we're talking Curtis Mayfield. And I put Curtis on a level with Bob Dylan and Merle Haggard, you know. And for whatever reason, he's playing to 80 people at the Palomino. And I was sitting there and I was bumming. And it was feeding into my whole screw the music, screw the world, screw everything, you know. And then he got on stage and he started playing. And it was like a magic wand just came in. Bam.
People get ready. There's a train a-coming. You don't need no baggage. You just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the diesels humming. You don't need no ticket. You just thank the Lord. I say you just thank the Lord.
And I realized, oh my God, he's playing to 80 people, and he's glorious. He was amazing. For the train to Jordan. I walked into the club, a cynical jerk, and suddenly I was transformed back to being a 12-year-old kid again.
Faith is the key. Open the doors and boredom. There's hope for all. Among those loved the most.
It's like when the cliches come true. I walked out, I'll do whatever the hell I want. The one thing is, I'll just be me. You know, I'm not a great singer. I'll sing, I don't care. If people make fun of me, fine. If critics give me a bad review, fine. It doesn't matter. You're going to play to 80 people and love it as much as Curtis did. And that's the goal. We'll be right back.
long. I'm never right, but always wrong. Goodbye, baby, so long. And you know, you never let this thing catch on.
Dave Alvin is still touring these days with his blues band, The Guilty Ones, and they've got a brand new album out called 1111. Michael May produced our story. And we still want to hear about the work of art that changed your life. It could be a song, a TV show, a novel, anything. Tell us about it at studio360.org. Coming up, I'll talk with the musician and composer Gabriel Kahane. He'll explain how he manages to straddle the line between classical and pop music. You're listening to Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. On any given weekend, you might hear Gabriel Kahane's music in a concert hall or in a bar in Brooklyn.
Do you ever feel alone? Let me tell you about something I know. A device, I made something for you.
Or in a proper theater, where he's got a new musical written with Seth Buckley called February House, now playing at the Public in New York. He's just released a solo record called Where Are the Arms? It has some of his folk rockiest music yet, but the work of an artful composer is still clearly there. Gabriel Kahane, welcome to Studio 360.
It's my pleasure to be here.
So why don't, before we talk, begin with a song?
Let's do it.
What will you play?
I think we'll play the opening cut from the record, which is called Charming Disease.
Great.
You were on the floor when I got home. I scraped you up, cleaned you off, got you out the door. I drove you to the basement on your knees. Sneaking out with little lights in the morning at the market for a good time. You tried to hide it by the lemon trees. I took you home and took away your keys. What a charming, what a charming, charming little. Charming, what a charming, charming little disease. Shuffled stare, 90 days, no guarantees. You
sank into the wine dark sea. You sank into the wine dark sea. You tried so hard, so hard to please. You sank into the wine dark sea. What a charming, what a charming, charming little disease. What a charming, what a charming, charming little disease. When I got home, held my breath, stepped real soft, and then I locked the door. I'll bring the bottle, I'll bring the bottle, I'll bring the bottle. I'll bring the bottle, I'll bring the bottle, I'll bring the bottle. I'll bring the bottle, I'll bring the bottle, I'll bring the bottle. Charming, what a charming, charming little disease. What a charming, charming little disease. What a charming, charming little disease.
That was Gabriel Kahane performing Charming Disease live in our studio. His new album is called Where Are the Arms. Is there a particular story in your life behind that song?
No, not particularly. I mean, I tend to write a lot from literature. And
so I've seen and heard.
And over the last year, I have been plowing through David Foster Wallace's tome, Infinite Jest, at a very, very slow pace. And his depiction of addiction, I think, really sort of got inside me. And this record, unlike the first one, which is largely confessional, sort of moves away from that and is more sort of fictional character based.
When you write classical music, and then you write pop songs, are you using different parts of your self, head, or is it all music?
It's all music, and I think more and more I've come to believe that, with the exception of that brief interval following World War II, when classical music was sort of hijacked by the Academy, there was always...
And made into things that most people didn't want to listen
exactly.
to.
Exactly. There was always a conversation between the vernacular and the more formally rigorous, if you will, from Bach interpolating folk songs into the Goldberg Variations through Mozart in the Magic Flute, and so on and so forth, up through Mahler and Ives, and I think it's
Copland and Gershwin and it's everybody.
Just, it's a tradition that just briefly got lost for a handful of decades. So I guess what I feel like I'm trying to do is, rather than being the ethnomusicologist who goes and forages the folk songs, that I'm trying to create a dialogue between my pop songs and the concert music. So it's taking very often the same genetic musical material and just treating it differently.
What was the first piece of music, of classical music, that just blew you away?
You know, it's funny. We were just, during soundcheck, we were joking about Brahms. And I think probably the Brahms G major violin sonata was the first piece that really just knocked me out. And as a seven-year-old, I would play the first four bars on the piano over and over again because that's all I could play. And that there's something so sacred to me about that music. And I remember going on a recital tour with my father when I was probably 8 years old. I think he was playing with Josh Bell, who was very young at the time. Probably,
the violinist.
Yes, probably younger than I am now. And they were playing that piece. And I just remember being so deeply moved by it.
Even beyond the first four bars.
Yes.
Speaking of your father, Jeffrey Kahane, who is a renowned classical pianist and conductor of the great Los Angeles Chamber Orchestra, what was it like as you decided this is what you wanted to do, to have this big deal classical musician as a father?
Well, I think it would have been much more convenient, narratively speaking, if there were a big tussle. But the truth is that my father was about as unpushy as he could have been growing up. And he also, as a teenager, had ambitions to play pop music and did, in fact, play with my mother in two rock bands, one called Brandywine after Tolkien and one called The American Revelation. And there's some incredible photos of them.
Well, that'll be good for the biopic, even though you and your father didn't fight.
But I think in a way, when things started to crystallize for me as a pop musician, my father, if he's to be taken at his word, is actually really moved by the fact that I've sort of realized an aspect of his musical ambitions that he was not able to at the same time that he's done all these brilliant things.
That's beautiful and perfect. You collaborate with him now some.
Yeah, we just played our first duo recital in March in Denver, and we had a blast, sort of mixed program. We had two pianos on stage, and he played some Schubert impromptus, and I sang my songs, and we did some Ives art songs together. It was a blast. And
did you write music that he had to play?
A couple of seasons ago, I wrote a piece for him. His only stipulation was that it be about his dog, his beloved dog,
Django. That was his stipulation?
His stipulation. So I wrote a piece called Django, Tiny Variations on a Big Dog, which he premiered at Lincoln Center a couple seasons ago.
And on the pop song part of what you've done and do, what was the song you heard at age 7 or whenever that made you think, wow, I love that?
I think it was probably a lot of Paul Simon's Graceland was the record that my parents were playing all the time, that and Sgt. Pepper. And I loved those records growing up.
Will you play us out with one of your songs?
Absolutely. I would love to. I think we'll do the title track. The song is called Where Are the Arms?
Terrific. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. My pleasure, Kurt.
pick up the floor, your broken toy. And where are the arms that aren't your love?
Gabriel Kahane's new musical, February House, is playing at New York's Public Theater. You can hear full versions of the songs he sang here today and watch a video of his performance at studio360.org. Also, by the way, starting right now, there's a new way to consume this show, the audio, the text, pictures, everything, using the Flipboard app on your iPhone or iPad. You can download it for free at flipboard.com/studio360. Before I sign off today, I wanted to say farewell and thanks to a beloved and talented Studio 360 producer. After 7 years making amazing radio for this show, my pal Derek John is returning to his native Midwest. We'll miss you, Derek, a lot. And that's it for this installment. Thanks very much for listening. Hope you listen next time. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Josh Rogerson,
Alana Harper,
Xicheng Lin,
Mujahid Salamid,
Thomas Seeley,
Krista Ripple,
Eve Asher,
Sarah Gook.
And thanks, as always, to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tiegum.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. Studio 360's American Icons Project is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Great ideas brought to life.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, a play about white flight in the 1950s and gentrification today. That should bother pretty much everybody.
People have said to me, you talk about really controversial topics in a somewhat cavalier way. You act like you're shocked that people get mad.
The playwright of the Pulitzer Prize-winning Clybourne Park. Next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.